All right, tonight is part two of the history of Israel, Herzl and the rise of political Zionism. Last week we discussed the Yeshuv HaYashan, which was the religious establishment in the land of Israel that existed from the 1700s. And we noted that overwhelmingly by 1880, most of the settlers were predominantly religious Jews. Not entirely, but predominantly the Yeshuv HaYashan and the Svardim who were there. And already there was a smattering of seculars who had come from Europe in the 1870s. But predominantly they were still religious. Even the Chovei Tzion, which really got underway in 1881, was perceived as a quasi-religious movement and was supported by many religious Jews, including Rabbanim, we noted last week, even though it also had a secular leadership. The head of it was Leon Pinsker, who we'll get back to a little later on. Now this would change. It would change for reasons which are typical in Jewish history, but unique to this period of time, because of the confluence of all these events. In the late 1880s, Russia was overwhelmed by riots against Jews, pogroms, such as it had never seen before. A little background, the worst of the 19th century czars was the Tsar Nicholas I. He became notable in our history for his cruelty, especially the famous Cantonist Act, which required that a certain number of Jews in every community be forcibly conscripted into the Tsar's army for a period of 25 years. So if you can imagine taking a Jew out of his home at the age of 18 and not returning him till he's 43, most of them did not return. Many were killed, and of those who survived, many, in order to survive, converted to Christianity and were lost. Now, among the terrible acts, we'll discuss this another time, that took place was in the many Jewish shtetlach, there arose a profession called a chaper. Jews who would literally chop the children of the poor, the wealthy would pay them to take the children of the poor and send them off to the Tsar's army, so that the children of the wealthy would not have to go. It was one of the terrible, terrible tragedies of the 19th century, which also had ramifications years later. So the Rabbanim were powerless to stop it, and yet were blamed for allowing its existence. In 1855, he was succeeded by his son, Alexander II, who, like many times you find, was relatively liberal. By those standards, he revoked Cantonism. He widened the Pale of Settlement, and he gave Jews more places which they could live in Russia, and he even allowed Jewish enrollment in universities. So there was a glimmer of hope, at least from a secular, enlightened perspective, that he'd be different. Nonetheless, Alexander II was still a Jew hater, and pogroms became a regular part of Jewish life, along with blood libels in the 1870s. He, in order to curry favor with the other Jew haters in his government and with the populace, reinstituted anti-Jewish measures like the decree of his father prohibiting Jews from wearing Jewish dress. He reinstituted quotas in the schools and universities. He was assassinated in 1881 in St. Petersburg, not by Jews, but of course Jews were blamed for it. And that sparked in 1881 massive riots and pogroms against Jews. He was succeeded by his son, Alexander III, who was hopeless from a Jewish perspective. And with this came a terrible disillusionment on the part of the Maskilim. Now the Maskilim, which was a movement in Jewish life, basically to divorce themselves from Torah while embracing certain cultural dimensions of Jewish life, along with a greater vision for the enlightenment and emancipation of society, the Maskilim had hoped, especially after Alexander II became Tsar, that Russia would be part of the wave of enlightenment and emancipation. And in fact, their hope for the advancement of Jewish civil rights in Russia faded very quickly, and now they saw no hope in Russia at all. At the same time, and because of this, there arose parallel to Chovei Tzion, which I said was Chibat Tzion, which was a quasi-religious movement, a movement, a secular group to encourage Aliyah from Russia, called BILU, Beis Yaakov Lechuv Anelcha, the acronym, Beis Yaakov Lechuv Anelcha, And as a little shtuch to everyone, so Yidav Matzai Shabbos and Ve'itan Lecha, we say this pasuk, Beis Yaakov L'chuvan Elcha B'or Hashem, that the house of Yaakov will go forth B'or Hashem by the light of God. They consciously deleted the last two words of the pasuk, Beis Yaakov L'chuvan Elcha, but not B'or Hashem. Together, Bilu and Chivat Zion constituted the first Aliyah from 1881 to 1903, which was a massive movement. I should clarify. The exodus from Russia and Eastern Europe was a massive movement. All told, from 1881 to 1914, over 3 million Jews left Eastern Europe. 3 million Jews. Most of those Jews came to America. Of those Jews, with all the talk we had last week of Chibat Zion and Bilu, etc., 1% went to Israel. 1%, it's roughly 30,000, but it basically doubled the population of Jews there. But this brought the first real influx, major influx, of non-religious Jews to Israel. And we'll speak again in a few minutes about the cultural clash that caused animosity, which really hasn't yet died down. Now, before we start with Herzl and the rise of political Zionism, let's understand the basic roots of secular Zionism. Why all of a sudden, after 19 centuries, was there this movement to start a Jewish homeland somewhere in the world? Well, I noted already Jew hatred, which was a very powerful cause. The pogroms in Russia in the 1880s led Jews to believe that life in Europe had no future. And, you know, we endure these shocks every few decades, but it underscored, Jews felt through much of the 19th century that what set them apart pejoratively from the rest of the society was clinging to the so-called outmoded ways of the Jewish past. Mitzvahs, with kashrus, or Shabbos, or milah, etc. All those things served to separate them, ghettoize them, in fact, from the population. And if he abandoned that without conversion, but remained Jews of a more secular, a cultural perspective, then together with the Enlightenment that swept Europe, there'd be a future for Jews. So Jew hatred was now a shock, because they saw that it did not, that this type of Enlightenment or mild assimilation did not work, and worse, it wasn't just the Cossacks or the peasants who were persecuting Jews. The big shock to the elitists of the Haskalah was that Jew hatred persisted amongst the intelligentsia of Europe, amongst the higher classes, even cosmopolitan circles such as in Paris or Germany, which was considered cosmopolitan then. I mentioned the other night that there was a best-selling work in France by Edouard Drumont in 1886, a two-volume, 1,200-page Jew-hating tract, a bestseller, essentially outlining why Jews are the cause of all the world's troubles. But that's 1,200 pages. That's a big book. And that's two volumes. Who buys multi-volume sets of anything today? But it was a bestseller in France. Already in 1878, there was a phrase coined by Wilhelm Marr, who was a German Jew hater, known as anti-Semitism. He felt, and correctly so, that anti-Semitism had less of a negative connotation. If you say anti-Jewish, people know what you're saying. If you say Jew hating, people know what you're saying. If you're just against Semites, well, who are Semites really? No one identifies as a Semite. So it became a sort of classy way to refer to Jew hatred. One reason why I never use the term, because they use the term so as to take the sting out of what they're doing. But in fact, he founded something called the Anti-Semitic League. You want to hate Jews? So here's an organization. We'll give you a membership card. There'll be dues. There'll be conventions, meetings, publications. We'll get together and discuss why we hate Jews. In 1895, Karl Luger was elected the mayor of Vienna on a Jew-hating platform. Vote for me, I hate Jews. Nothing about municipal development. I hate Jews. That was his message to the people, and they bought it. So Naskelim became very disillusioned, and they embraced the notion of forming a perfect society in Israel. Now, I noted last week the important role played by the rise of European nationalism. So that was a great influence on Rav Alkalai and Rav Kalischer, but also on secular Jews. As noted first in 1862, a Jew named Moses Hess wrote a book called Rome and Jerusalem. And by Rome, he didn't mean Rome from the time of the Churban. He meant Rome from the year before. And just like Rav Kalischer had noted this, the fact that Italy was able to coalesce and form one cohesive state after being divided for centuries into different duchies and papal states gave him inspiration. If Rome could do it, so Jerusalem could do it as well. It was a reference to the successful drive for independence in Italy. Now, Hess himself grew up religious, but he became a colleague of Marx and Engels, became a communist. And he wrote very simply that Jews will never be accepted in Europe. The only hope for Haskalah to succeed would be the development of a colony in Israel. In 1881, the aforementioned Leon Pinsker, who became the head of Chibat Zion, wrote a book called Auto-Emancipation. Auto-Emancipation, free yourself. He was an assimilated doctor. He said, not wrongly, that only Jews could solve the Jewish problem, and only Jews are to blame if they don't solve the Jewish problem. And he wrote that mankind persecutes us because we are unnatural. We have no fatherland, we have no government, we're like a man without a shadow. And a man without a shadow really does not have existence. It means he's not projecting anything. Pinsker wrote in his book, and I quote, a reason we all know, because this reverberates the last century and a half, why Jews will never be accepted and never be able to assimilate. He said, for the living, the Jew is a dead man. For the natives, an alien and a vagrant. For property holders, a beggar. For the poor, an exploiter and a millionaire. For the patriot, a man without a country. For all classes, a hated rival. That's what Pinsker wrote in 1881, and he himself concluded that the only hope was to establish some Jewish colony in the land of Israel where they would be able to live their own and free the Europeans from the necessity of persecuting them. Notice, there's nothing in Hess's work or in Pinsker's work about the Geula, about redemption, about Bias HaMashiach. That was not their concern. That even was not their belief. But nonetheless, these two works created a stir, a mild stir to be sure, but a stir in the Jewish world in Europe, and people began to talk about it. As it became more commonplace in cultural circles, so the poets took hold of it, and in 1878 already, again, Herzl was just 18 years old at the time, Naftali Herz Imber wrote what he called Tikvatenu. Tikvatenu, our hope, which later, about three or four decades later, was called Hatikva. It's very possible that he wrote Tikvatenu in response to the founding of Petach Tikva, which in the same year, which greatly impressed him that a Jewish city could arise in the sands of what then was basically desert. Imber himself was a strange duck. As we'll see, many of these personalities were just strange ducks. He bounced across the world from country to country as a poet. I don't know what poets earn today, but they didn't earn much in the 1870s. He went to India, he went to England, even came to America. In America, he fell in love with a Protestant woman, wealthy woman. She converted, but they divorced soon after. And he died penniless in America, and I think he's even buried somewhere in America now as well. Now his words, Adavurcha, underwent many revisions over the years. So his original refrain, Odlo Avda Tikvatenu, our hope is not yet lost, Hatikva Hanoshana, the old ancient hope, Lashuv Leretz Avotenu, to return to the land of our fathers, Leir Ba David Chana. Not Eretz Yerushalayim. That was really very far-fetched. La'ir ba David Chana, to the city in which David dwelled. That was the original text. Now the text over the years was changed. In fact, the phrase Liotam Chofshi Bar Tzeinu, Eretz Yerushalayim, is of much later vintage, maybe four or five decades after he wrote it, and therefore I myself never sing Liotam Chofshi, as many others do. I say Liotam Kadosh, and the first time I announced it, people looked at me as if I'm tampering with something Anshe Knesset Gdola wrote. The fact is, even Imber didn't write that. Chofshi also had a certain shtuch to it, because in the phrase of the Talmud, only time it's used is to describe someone as chofshi min ha-mitzvos. Kevon shemeis nasa chofshi min ha-mitzvos. When you're dead, you're free of mitzvos. We are dam chofshi, that was the intention. Chofshi, we're free of any albatross that existed in Jewish life before. Now, the melody was not Imber's, as we know. He never set it to music. But already in the 1880s, they adopted a Czech folk song by Bendrik Smetana called The River Malda, which is a very well-known Czech tune. And in fact, my wife could verify, we flew into Prague a couple of years ago, and as we landed in Prague, we greeted on the airline, on Czech Air, with this tune. Da 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 da. Dun, 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 and it's a bit unnerving to hear it, but that's the Czech folk tune. Again, like many tunes, I guess Schlockrock does this all the time. You take a popular secular tune and set it to different words, and then people know it. Now, it had a hard time catching on in the Jewish world. As you know, there are other poets out there. Some say it was sung at the first Zionist Congress, others say not. Everyone agrees it was unanimously acclaimed in 1905. And in 1933, it was adopted as the official Zionist anthem. When the state was declared on May 14, 1948, it was sung at that hall in Tel Aviv. After the declaration of the Proclamation of Independence was signed, when did it become Israel's official national anthem? Never. The Knesset has never voted it Israel's official national anthem. Every few years, including the last time, I remember, two or three years ago, some right-winger raises that issue of letting the Knesset vote on it to make it Israel's official national anthem, and it's always shot down. The argument being that we all know what goes on in Israel today. There are about 20%, 25% of the country are not Jews. So you can't have an anthem that says, Nefesh Yehudi, Ho Miyo, O Lov, the Tikvotenu. There are too many citizens of Israel that are not Jews. So there has never been adopted officially as Israel's national anthem. Nonetheless, it had an effect. It had an effect, like all these cultural excursions have an effect as they seep into the popular mind. Now, the secular ideology of Pinsker and others, a decade later, in the 1890s, was supplemented by the socialists in their utopian ideals, which we'll discuss next time. And these obviously clashed very intensely with the existing yeshuv. And the Jewish population basically doubled in a very short time, but now with internal strife. Now with two communities that were at odds in every way possible, ideologically, economically, hashkafically, halachically. They just looked at the world different ways. Not only secular versus religious, that is to say Torah versus anti-Torah, with all its concomitant effect on Shabbos and Mitzvot and Talmud Torah and the public domain, but also values and lifestyle. The old yeshuv favored, as I noted last week, the chalukah system. They're very content to sit and learn and rely on handouts from abroad. And in fact, they eschewed gainful employment. One of the legacies, still exists today, of course, one of the legacies that we still have from the 1870s and 80s is a charity known as Kupat Rabbi Meir Balanes. You've all seen that, the tzedakah box. That pushta was established in the Jewish world to raise money for the old yeshuv, the tzedakah of Rabbi Meir Balanes. So you had one group that wanted just to sit and learn, and another group, even including many religious Jews, who wanted to work and to farm and to build and to settle. In the 1880s already, the seculars began to gain the upper hand, if only numerically,
And there were, in fact, religious Jews who were focused on what we call nation building, settlement, farming, etc., but the tide had turned. I noted last week the first settlement, Nachlat Shiva, that started outside the old city of Yerushalayim in the 1870s, really. Another famous community developed, considered at the time a very modern, progressive community, known to us as Mea Shearim. Mea Shearim, because of its 100 gates and a pasuk in Toldos, Mea Shearim was a modern community of people who had decided to leave the confines of the old city and establish their home at some distance. Of course, relatively short, but then subject to all the hazards of life outside a walled city. Mea Shearim today is basically unchanged from the way it was in the 1870s. Many of the buildings still exist, and certainly, aside from the addition of electricity, which is sparingly used, you find life there goes on much as it did in the past. Now, something else, another current in the Jewish world we should note, even though it didn't really exist in the land of Israel at the time, but later came to the land of Israel, and that is religious anti-Zionism. That is, from this perspective, a relatively older movement. Already in the 1830s, which was shortly before Rav Alkalai published his first work, but there was already talk of going to Eretz Yisrael, the Moshe Teitelbaum, who was the ancestor of the famous Teitelbaum family that exists until today, the Yismach Moshe, was the Rav in Uli, in Romanian Hungary. So he said, he wrote, posited, that it's God's will that we remain in exile until Mashiach comes. So he didn't write this in response to the Zionist movement. That was 60 years in the future. He wrote this right in the 1830s, and they're nothing if not consistent in their philosophy and persistent in maintaining that philosophy. Nothing can change it. What's interesting from our perspective is that it was a new doctrine. No one ever suggested such a thing before, that you couldn't return to the land of Israel, or even have some type of political establishment in the land of Israel until Bias Mashiach. He innovated that. Now we think, you know, because of the way they talk, goes back to the Gemara. But in fact, it's not so. His grandson, the Yativ Lev, they have to go from here to one of the catering halls in Williamsburg, Rose Castle or Eden Palace, that was past Congregation Yativ Lev. His grandson, the Yativ Lev of Yekusil Yehuda of Siget, subscribed to the same philosophy. He went even a step further. He forcibly prevented people from going to Israel as best he could in the 1850s and 60s. Now, at that time, the ideology was fairly docile until the advent of secular Zionism. When secular Zionism arose in the 1880s and 90s, so it gave it the justification that the Zionist enterprise could and would fail. One other point of interest before we actually get to Herzl's involvement, and that is another controversy that exists until today that we will revisit next year. In 1889, that was the first Shemitah year since the new Jewish communities were established, the new farming communities in the land of Israel. And the question was what to do. It became a relatively simple answer at the time because Baron Rothschild, who was underwriting the enterprise and was not the firm man, saw, or at least himself predicted what would happen if they stopped farming for a year, basically negating everything he'd done, ruining the vines that he brought over from France, and he said he would cut off funds to the new yeshuv if Shemitah was observed. Rav Shmuel Moliver, who brought in Rothschild to the notion of resettlement of the land of Israel, wrote what he called a heter mechira, a permit selling the land to the local Arabs for the year, allowing the Jews to work it. This heter mechira was opposed then by the Netziv, who remember was a big supporter of Kibbutz Zion, by the Beis Halevi, or Yeshiva Be'er Soloveitchik, by Rav Hirsch, by many others, but it did win some rabbinic support, including, and importantly, Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Spector, the chief rabbi of Kovno, and acknowledged as probably the Gadol Hador. Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Spector, of course, Rietz was named after him, endorsed it, Whether they would have done it anyway without his endorsement, we don't know, but it was done. They worked the land. It was controversial then. We'll see. Rav Kook re-endorsed it 20 years later. Essentially, every 7 years now, the Rabbanut goes through what by today is a fiction, because so much is imported anyway, that they could still sell the land, and if they don't, the entire enterprise of the Jewish state would collapse. But as the years go on, more and more people, more and more farmers refuse to abide by the Heta Mechira, such that probably next year, which is a Shemitah year, more than half, or maybe 60% of the farmers in Israel will not till the soil during the Shemitah year. Theodor Herzl was born in 1860 in Budapest. His home, his father was wealthy, then lost his money. His home is right next to the Dohany Street Temple in Budapest. Now it's called the Herzl Museum. You could visit it. He was bar mitzvah, such as it was in the Dohany Street Temple. It was called by him and them. Dohany was a neologue. He wasn't Orthodox. His confirmation, he had religious grandparents. In fact, rumor is that his grandfather was a supporter of Rav Alkali, but his parents were completely assimilated. Herzl was, again, a character, certainly a historic character, but a real character. Striking appearance, tall, dark, black beard, long beard, piercing black eyes, fond of pomp. He would always wear in public a top hat and tails, very formal in appearance, very intelligent, a fine writer. He had a doctorate in law. That's what people called him. He asked to be called Dr. Herzl. And he became a playwright first, was unsuccessful, and a journalist. Well, he was unsuccessful as a playwright, but he did infuse the coming Zionist movement with tremendous theatricality, for which he was known. Now, Herzl moved to Vienna in the in his early 20s, became a journalist for a new paper run by a Jew, a secular Jew, and there, for the first time in his life, he really encountered Jew hatred on a massive scale. Now, he was always a thinker. He was always a dreamer, Herzl. And again, it's the type of thing that there are these people coming to the world, I mentioned last week, Meshugoa Davar, they're always thinking, always hatching some scheme, and they're able to move history forward by the force of their personality and the fact that they're able to draw in enough supporters for their vision. One of his supporters was never his wife, or for that matter, his children. There's a whole question, in fact, whether his wife was Jewish. We do know she was the daughter of a millionaire, and that is what underwrote Herzl's activities for many years. We know for sure that he never gave her kiddushin. There was never any Jewish wedding. His son, Hans, never had a bris. More about him later. And Herzl was completely assimilated. And as he moved now in the cosmopolitan circles in Vienna in the 1880s and into the early 1890s, especially when he came to France on business to work, he wrote that the only solution to the Jewish problem is mass conversion to Christianity. This is 1892. Mass conversion to Christianity, and as I mentioned, he was quite theatrical. He envisioned a grand parade of all the leaders of the Jews, followed by thousands of Jews, down some major boulevard, up to the throne where the Pope would be, and there all Jews would pledge allegiance to Catholicism, and that would end Jew hatred in the world. His son, in fact, later did convert to Christianity. He said there was no other hope. By 1894, he published this, and it was widely circulated. By 1894, though, Herzl had withdrawn these plans because he saw that not only in Vienna, but in France as well, Jew hatred persisted, despite the fact that Jews were not identified publicly as Jews. Somehow, Jew haters could always ferret them out, and he embarked on a new campaign, that of the Jewish state. Now again, Herzl wasn't necessarily the first, but he was the most successful. The term Zionism came into our lexicon already in 1893 by another interesting Jew named Nathan Birnbaum, who was a student at the University of Vienna. So he wrote a book, or pamphlet actually, called The Rejuvenation of the Jewish Nation as a Solution to the Jewish Problem. The title was almost as long as the book. But it was a pamphlet, 1893 it came out, and Birnbaum also noted the persistence of Jew hatred. He was a secular Jew from an assimilated background, and he said the only answer is a homeland. Jew hatred will persist unless we're given a homeland, and he wrote that our only hope is a Jewish national center in the land of Israel. If that happened, its impact would be a strengthening of moral and national awareness throughout the diaspora, and the standing of the Jewish nation among the Gentiles would change too. And he ended saying, "Give us a land!" Exclamation point. That is the secret of the solution to the Jewish problem. So wrote Birnbaum in 1893. For a variety of reasons, Jews are always involved in thought. He broke with the Zionist movement a few years later, and he became a prominent Yiddishist. The Yiddishists were those who felt that Torah was of no value anymore, Rahman al-Islam, but the hope for the Jewish people would be in the flourishing of Yiddish culture. Some of their remnants, those flickering embers, still exist today in New York and parts of Israel as well. There is still a Yiddish culture, even a Yiddish literature movement, but it's very small. And the great irony of life is the only people who really read Yiddish today are the Hasidim, who would never even entertain reading one of their books. When I worked as a lawyer in above my office was an apartment building where there lived a fellow named, I think his name is Kanyak, I forget. I think that was his name. But he was one of the most famous Yiddish authors of the 20th century. And by the end of his life, he died in the late, I guess around 1990 or so, by the end of his life he was completely unknown because his target audience had assimilated. But Birnbaum was a Yiddishist, and he said that's the hope for the Jews. He then left the Yiddish movement, and he became one of the progenitors, the ideological progenitors of Agudas Yisrael. So he really went from one end to the other, and when he died, he was a Baal Tshuva, and he was one of the heads of Agudas Yisrael, which we founded in 1912. But he coined the term Zionism, and he put it on the map, and people started to discuss it. And in that environment, in that milieu, Herzl seized upon this idea and other ideas as well. Shabbos afternoon, I discussed at some length the Dreyfus trial. Dreyfus, just briefly, was a captain in the French army who was set up, accused of treason, and convicted, court-martialed, convicted of treason, sentenced to life on Devil's Island on the flimsiest of evidence. That provoked, his trial did, in December 1895, wild anti-Jewish riots in, of all places, Paris. Who could imagine such a thing? Paris having riots against Jews. Actually happened a year ago also in 2005. But it made a deep impression on Herzl because he saw again, just like the Russian Jews had seen in the 1880s, that assimilation was hopeless. Already during the trial, he started work jotting down ideas. It's said that Herzl constantly wrote, even on paper money, and he saved every scrap that he wrote. So there's a very extensive literary history from Herzl. Already during the trial, he started writing, the trial was just 4 days, but he started writing the outlines of his book, which became Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, what the Jewish state would be like. And it was released just a few weeks after, or I should say, an excerpt was published in the press. The first excerpt, just a few weeks after Dreyfus was stripped of his military rank in January 1895 and sent off to Devil's Island. Herzl's Der Judenstaat was both prescient and bizarre. The basic point was true, that Jews could never assimilate even if they desired. But if you could judge a book by its cover, this is the one you want to judge by its cover. Herzl's vision of a Jewish state bears almost no reality to the Israel that was later created. Herzl advocated a territory for Jews. It didn't matter to him whether it was in Israel or Argentina. Argentina had a Jewish colony that was funded by a millionaire named Baron Maurice Hirsch. in which he settled 6,000 Jews there away from the persecution of Europe. So he said either Israel or Argentina. He actually favored Israel. He envisioned a state which the national language would be German. The flag would have seven stars on it, symbolizing the 7 hours of the workday, a state which would be permeated with European culture, theaters and cafes. The book, by the way, is not more than 80 pages. I read it years ago. You should all read it. Very interesting reading. Theaters and cafes, opera houses in which they would play Wagner, great plazas and public parks that would rival all the cities in Europe, especially Italy. Clergy would be kept in their rightful place in the temple and never outside. A lot of Jews feel even today in America. All this would be accomplished. He laid out every detail step by step. He would form what he called, quote, in capitals, the Society of Jews. The Society of Jews, no relation, I imagine, to the elders of Zion, but the Society of Jews would be the representatives of the Jewish people to the world to try to advocate on behalf of the Jewish homeland, and a separate organization called the Jewish Company to handle the finances and do the actual work of state building to be financed by Jewish banks and the wealthy Jews of the world, and secondarily or tertiarily the Jewish masses in whom he did not have much hope. Now, Birnbaum, in fact, was the one who suggested to Herzl that he not use the phrase Judenstaat, Jewish state, but use the phrase homeland, because he felt that homeland would be less threatening to the nations of the world, but Herzl persisted. To say the least, Herzl was very ambitious, and he was able to maneuver his way despite the intense opposition that he generated. And he generated intense opposition from the majority of Jews. Secular Jews, by and large, disassociated themselves from Herzl because they were afraid of the charge of dual loyalty, and they did not want to be put in a homeland with other Jews. For that reason, they became secular. Reform Jews opposed Zionism until 1948. And within Reform today, there's still strains of anti-Zionism. They opposed it because they said that's not part of our world. We are citizens wherever we are, and it's not part of our religious outlook. Many of the settlers in the land of Israel opposed him because they thought that his plan would arouse a great opposition, especially from the Ottomans and the rest of the world as well, and would hurt their plans for growth. Here the settlers, the new yeshuv, had a sort of deal with the Sultan. They would bribe him every now and then and buy more land. The Jewish National Fund was created in the late 1890s. They would buy land. And if the Sultan thought that their ultimate goal was not to remain wards of Turkey, but to establish an independent state, he would stop. Rothschild himself, Hanadiv HaYadua, rejected Herzl, saying the Jewish people would never support such an idea. The most that we could hope for is a presence, but the idea of having a Jewish state where the Jewish nation would be reconstituted 19 centuries after the exile, that can't be. He had other opponents as well. One was a famous Jew named Achad Ha'am, nicknamed Achad Ha'am, Asher Ginzburg. The Russian Jew became, was raised religious, but became a maskil. The name Achad Ha'am was a phrase that's taken from the Chumash, not such a pleasant phrase. And this Parshas told us that Avimelech said to Yitzchak when he pretended that Rivka was his sister, he says, Achad Ha'am could have lived with her, slept with her. Nonetheless, he called himself Achad Ha'am. Now, Ginzburg opposed Herzl as well. He always advocated. He was a bit of a troublemaker. He was an idea man. And he advocated that before there could be the possibility of a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state, there needs to be a cultural revival of the Jewish people. What he, in fact, called a spiritual revival of the Jewish people, but without Torah and mitzvos. So Achad Ha'am also opposed the Chibat Zion movement. He said, not wrongly, that material power without Jewish culture would be a grave danger to the Jewish people. Now, the notion of having Jewish culture without Torah also still exists today. And many of the ideas that he advocated, as Herzl's for that matter, I mean, they were both right in many things, and they're both wrong in many things. If you take an amalgam somehow of the both of them, then you'd have a coherent political philosophy. He was very famous for saying that more than the Jews kept the Shabbos kept the Jews. Now, mind you, he's a secular person saying that, because he maintained that's part of the Jewish cultural identity. That's something he gave the world. The notion of a day of rest. This slogan of Echad HaAm was actually cited by the Israeli Supreme Court no less than 2 weeks ago, when they ruled against these kibbutzim that wanted to have their shops open on Shabbos. So the court ruled, it was a close vote, but they ruled that they're not allowed to have it open on Shabbos, because Shabbos is part of the cultural heritage of the Jewish people. It's interesting the way these things play out, because, in fact, it's attuned with our religious sensitivities, but from a completely different perspective. Now there's enforcement of Shabbos law in Israel, not because the Frum want it. In fact, if the religious made too big a deal about it, they'd vote against it. But it's because it's part of the cultural heritage of the Jewish people, and it's part of the rights of the worker. So why should the worker have to work 7 days a week? That's abusive. And since modern Israel was founded with a socialist ethos that protects the rights of the workers, it's unfair. Be that as it may, the court 2 weeks ago quoted in its climax, Echad HaAm, saying this is part of the cultural history of the Jewish people. But so he opposed Herzl, and he said that first we have to revive the spirit of the Jew, then we'll be ready for nationhood. And the religious, by and large, opposed him as well. The religious response to Herzl was divided between the curious, between the cautiously optimistic, and outright antagonists who were turned off by Herzl's secularism and his Jewish ignorance. Herzl didn't even know Hebrew. They just turned off. They couldn't see any positive legacy for Herzl or any of his ideas. So most of the Rabbonim opposed him, lukewarm at first, and we'll see much more intensely later on. Herzl wrote in his diary, "It will always be, I quote, one of the great curiosities of our period that rabbis should be praying for Zion and working against it." And there is truth to what he was saying, but he didn't see any of the problems in any of the ideas that he advocated. So Herzl didn't have support from the elites of the Jews. From where came his support? The masses of Jews. Masses of Jews, especially amongst the poor, downtrodden Jews of Russia, were greatly enthusiastic. It was like a boost, something out of the blue. In fact, one of them, I think it was Chaim Weizmann, who said Herzl was a bolt out of the blue. Even though they weren't what Herzl had in mind for the Jewish state, he saw the Jewish state as consisting of the cosmopolitan Jews of Western Europe, not the peasant O-student. Nonetheless, they became his base of support. Naturally, who's always involved in the ferment of new ideas? Students. So Jewish university students in Austria and elsewhere became his supporters. And another later well-known Jew named Max Nordau, Dr. Max Nordau, known to us again as Rehov Nordau, that you find in many cities. He was a Viennese doctor. The famous story, probably a legend, but it's too good not to tell. Completely assimilated, from an assimilated background. As the story goes, Nordau was treating a young religious boy in his office in Vienna in the 1890s, again, completely assimilated. And he said to him, maybe to make conversation, "What did you learn today in Cheder?" And the boy said that they learned the pasuk in Vayichi, where Yaakov is talking to Yosef and trying to convince Yosef to send him back to Eretz Yisrael for burial. So Yaakov explains why he had to bury Rachel on the Derech, and he said, "V'ani bevuimi Padon, when I came back from Padon Aram, Meisolai Rachel Beretz Kanan Baderech, my wife Rachel died on the way, Ba'od Kivas Eretz L'Bafrasa, before we came to Efrat, And there she was buried. And Norda listened to this boy recite the pasuk so fluently, and he said that a nation that remembers where its great grandmothers are buried is an eternal nation, and they'll never just disappear into the abyss. And as the story goes, that convinced Nordau not to become a Shomer Shabbos, but to convince him at least that assimilation was not the answer to the Jewish problem. When Herzl arose, actually, when Birnbaum first wrote, Nordau made contact with him, and then he became a great ally of Herzl. When Herzl published Der Judenstaat, Nordau wrote to him, "If you are insane, we are insane together. Count on me." And he became Herzl's right-hand man, and when Herzl dies in 1904, Nordau becomes the leader of the World Zionist Organization. Herzl, after he published Der Judenstaat, began traveling the Jewish world to Russia and Turkey and Germany and France and England and others as well, to go above the heads of the Jewish communities and speak right to the people, which is always a wise move if you want to make any progress in the Jewish world even today. In Bulgaria, came to Sofia. In Bulgaria, came to the capital, Sofia. He was proclaimed the Mashiach by the chief rabbi. He didn't think he was, but he soaked up the adulation, and it no doubt inspired him as well. And within a year, he endeavored to have a foundation meeting of his movement called the World Zionist Organization, and he called a convention. Jews always love conventions. The first Zionist Congress met in Basel, Switzerland, August 29th or 31st in 1897. Delegates came from 16 countries, including the United States. The first choice of Herzl, by the way, had been Munich. But the Jewish community in Munich said no, because they feared a charge of Jewish dual loyalty. Switzerland's always a little more open to that, so it was held there. It actually took place in the municipal casino of Basel, and was a gamble. It was a gamble, but it electrified the Jewish world. One Jew got up and even said the Bracha Shechayonu, B'Shemu Malchus. And even Achad HaAm, who was not a supporter, said, and I quote, that the first Zionist Congress was a great public statement that the Jewish people are still alive and want to go on living. Not that other nations will hear it and grant our desire, but we ourselves hear an echo from a voice in the depths of the soul, which might then awake and shake off its degradation. The purpose, the mission statement, so to speak, of the convention, of the Congress, was to, quote, to secure for the Jewish people a homeland in Palestine secured by public law. And notice Herzl also had now shelved the notion of a state in favor of a homeland. This became a revolution. This sparked a revolution in Jewish life. In many ways, thenceforth, Zionism had to be dealt with, and it became a riveting topic. Can it be? How can it be? What should it be? And that topic still exercises us 110 years later. Now, the Congress, from that perspective, was a success. Herzl was elected the president of the World Zionist Organization to cries of Yechi HaMelech, which Chabad still uses in a different context, though. But Yechi, you let the king live. And they voted, as all Jewish organizations do, to meet again the next year. But more importantly, Herzl realized, because of the strength of the response from the assembled, that indeed, Im Tirtzu, Ein Zu Agadah. If there really is a will, then it's not a dream, it's not the fantasy. It can come to place. And he saw that there was a community of like-minded Jews in the grassroots who, if they would not join him, would at least support him. That there were those who would go out on the limb with him as well. Not his natural class of westernized, assimilated, secular Jews, but the East European Jews, whom Herzl called, somewhat unkindly, his army of schnurrers. Because they're the ones who had the most to gain and the least to lose by the prospects of a Jewish homeland. Most of the attendees at the first Zionist Congress were not religious. A handful were. It did attract some religious Jews as well. And this set the tone for the divided response, which of course, ad hayom, nothing ever changes, we have until this day. I think I said it the first time, the positions articulated in the 1890s by various factions still exist today. Still, almost no change. You could take the arguments that they made then in writing and read them today, and you know who the players are. The official position of the first Zionist Congress was religious neutrality when it came to Torah matters, which to them sounded good. To religious Jews, neutrality is not good, but for a start, it was tolerable. At the second Zionist Congress, which we'll discuss more next time, in 1898, they adopted what was called a cultural platform, and that initiated anti-Jew, anti-Torah, not legislation, but programming. There the goal was articulated to create what they called a new Jew, a Jew not bound again by the chains of the exile, the antiquated practice of the past, but a new Jew who could live in the reborn Jewish state. And this, of course, repulsed many Orthodox Jews who became overt antagonists of Zionism. Now, in context, they weren't necessarily wrong, because the Zionist movement indeed became the last dying breath of the Maskilim. Of course, it was that, but of course it was much more than that, but in the context of the times, they could not see that. The last dying breath of the Maskilim, who had kidnapped a classical Jewish idea, Shiva Tzion, and secularized it, detached it from the Torah, detached it from Sinai, really detached it from Jewish history. People who proclaimed that we're now a people or a nation united not by the Torah, but by a land. This was something new. Zionism was perceived not unfairly as just another vehicle to wage war against the Torah. And of course, that is what was known. In hindsight, we may look at it differently, but that was known then. In the late 1890s, it is in fact 1899, Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, wrote a letter to another rabbi saying as follows: I read your words on the issue of the Zionist cult, which has now become strongly consolidated. I'm not ashamed to say that seeing that each of its members has earned an evil reputation in its place of dwelling, I don't know of ways to confront them. They've already proclaimed their goal to uproot the basis of the Jewish faith, and to attain it, they've made inroads in all places of Jewish settlement so as to enlist other Jews to assist them. That was Reb Chaim in 1899. That same year, the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, Yitzhak Yerucham Diskin, wrote as well, you ought to know that the religious community of the Holy City is at a low state, and they're helpless to remedy their condition. Most Torah-observant Jews are subject to the whims of the new masters who have sold their souls to the heretical Zionists. There have been more positive expressions when Rav Kook came, but not entirely adulatory. Even Rav Kook was never completely praiseworthy, because it was a new phenomenon in Jewish life. And yet, Herzl was unbound, and the events at Basel created in amongst the Jewish people a storm that really set off much conversation, a buzz of activity. You'll recall as well that very famous iconic image of Herzl at Basel, standing on the balcony of his hotel, looking over the looking at the Rhine River with such plaintive eyes, gazing into the distance as if he's looking into the future. That picture became a staple in Jewish homes in the 20th century, and it's been reprinted thousands of times, but that was the image. Herzl began traveling the world again, now president of the WZO, as the representative officially of the Jewish people, and he always made a tremendous impression on people. Keep in mind, he was a bit of a dandy. He insisted at all the Zionist congresses of which he presided, everybody had to come in top hat and tails. And Herzl always traveled with white gloves, and whenever he would meet any nobleman, he was always dressed. He was a very tall person as well, so he made a deep impression on people.
Among them, names we'll get to know in the coming months, Ben-Gurion heard already at the age of 10, Herzl came to Russia, and Ben-Gurion wrote later in his diary, that he heard, quote, the Messiah had arrived, and the Messiah was that handsome man, a learned man of Vienna, a doctor no less, a law doctor, but a doctor. That's what Ben-Gurion wrote, that was the impression. Weizmann signed on already in the late 1890s. Herzl met several times with the Kaiser, tried to talk the Sultan into selling land in Israel. He himself visited the land of Israel in 1898 and had one of his meetings with the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, in the land of Israel. That visit by the Kaiser, Agav Urcha, in 1898, there are ramifications until today. He refused to lower his head, riding on his steed, into the old city of Yerushalayim. So that is when they breached the wall next to Shar Yafo. That was the only wall of the old city that was completely open. He was to go under in the opening, in the entranceway, he had to bend down. Wilhelm II refused, so they tore down part of the wall to allow him to enter, 12 feet high, riding his horse. Now, everyone rebuffed Herzl, including the Kaiser. The Kaiser thought he was a dreamer, a hopeless dreamer, and he said to him in a very well-known story that for the Jewish state to come into existence, both the Ottoman Empire and the Prussian Empire and the Russian Empire all have to collapse. And he said the likelihood of any one of these happening is remote. Of each of them collapsing, that's near impossible. 20 years later, they're all gone. The Ottomans and the Kaiser and the Tsar as well. Herzl was an unusual, a great, tragic figure, a man, of course, of historic dimensions. Rav Kook himself, later on in life, would liken Herzl to Mashiach ben Yosef, charged with the rebuilding of the material infrastructure of the reborn Jewish Commonwealth. So he invested all his money in the enterprise, literally made himself sick of heart disease. He died at the age of 44, and he would die penniless at the age of 44. His family would be impoverished, so impoverished that for decades, collections would be made at the Zionist Congress to support his widow and his children. Unfortunately, they had very unhappy lives. His daughter, one of his daughters, died in a mental hospital in France. Years later, a drug addict. His son Hans, who had converted to Christianity, committed suicide on the day of her burial in Bordeaux. His third child, a daughter, died in Theresienstadt. He had a grandson from that daughter who served in the British Army in World War II, visited Israel, in fact, during World War II, became a British attaché in the embassy in Washington after the war, and he himself committed suicide in the late 1940s. So it's very interesting. As we start this topic, two of his children, the one who died in the mental hospital, and Hans, were just brought back to Israel this past August for reburial on Har Herzl. Another guy took it upon himself, saying it's not right that Herzl's children should be buried in some godforsaken non-Jewish cemetery when their father did so much for Klal Yisrael, he's buried here. So in fact, they were brought back. There was a finding, so to speak, of the Rabbanut that Hans himself had repented on his deathbed and re-embraced the Jewish people and Judaism, so they allowed him to be reburied in Yerushalayim. We'll return next week to some of the ups and downs that Herzl had after the First Zionist Congress, ups and downs with the Jews, Ugandan plan, the struggle between the political Zionists and what became known as the practical Zionists, those who wanted to put state building on the back burner and just focus on settlement, the founding of religious Zionism, and Rav Kook's arrival in Israel. And we'll do it now sequentially. We'll go decade by decade, starting next week with the 19-0s. But just to end with this classic tidbit from these times. Herzl wrote in his diary in 1897, "Were I to sum up the Basel Congress in a word, which I shall guard against pronouncing publicly, it would be this. At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be answered by universal laughter. Perhaps in 5 years, and certainly in 50,
Everyone will know it. 50 years later, it was 1947. He was indeed quite prophetic, to the minute almost, that it would be a long, twisted, and bloody road until the Jewish state was achieved. Thank you very much.
Two updates. In the Knesset in 2004 passed an amendment to the Chok HaSemel VaHadegel, the law of national symbols and flags and the hymn, and adopted HaTikva as the official national anthem of the State of Israel. That was reinforced in July 2018 by the new nation-state law, which, among other things, declared as well, affirmatively, that HaTikva is the official national anthem of the State of Israel. Additionally, whereas in 2007 the courts enforced the no-work on Shabbat laws, they have become much more lax in recent years, and some courts, in fact, have allowed enterprises to be open on Shabbat, and that remains an open dispute today in the land of Israel.